You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Greetings, people of Earth. Welcome to episode 139 of the podcast.
I'm sorry. Pharaoh March 13, Alpha 13, Renegade 13, or whatever you would like to be referred to as at the moment.
My guest this week is...
It's your boy Pharaoh March, legendary organized confusion, Pharaoh March, internal affairs, Pharaoh March. Producer, Pharaoh March, MC, Pharaoh March, action figure collector, and Pharaoh March director. So I just directed two of the last videos on the last project, so put that on the repertoire too.
Ooh, and more criminally slept on than maximum security prison pillows are wept on.
Yo.
Let me speak about the way he used to dribble off his knees, and in the middle at the same time, guzzling the beer like a puzzle or a riddle. Covering his path through the hoop, scoop, shot, tip at the backboard, hoops. Sun guy hops, never knew he would've threw it. Cool nigga, when it came to school, he blew it. A scholar in acute niggerisms and metropolitans. Get tolerant, yo Donovan, hey, come around the block. Youngest of three sons, fucking with coupons and refunds, food stamps. Still he was a champ. Time to get loose for boots and kicks now. Fuck hoops, gotta impress the chicks now. His mama said, Donovan, why are you on the corner of London and got all? He said, mama, listen close, I'ma tell you one time, you're killing my high, plus I got a nine.
This week I'm honored to sit down with the one and only Pharaoh March and give you a detailed conversation that runs from art school to the Cannes Film Festival, and all the achievements and earthquakes in between. From emerging from South Jamaica, Queens as one half of organized confusion in the late 1980s, to a new project, A Magnificent Day for an Exorcism, with Daru Jones and Marcus Machado. You casuals probably know him best as Simon Says, and the hardcore ones know that he's probably in the top 10 lyricists of all time. So no matter which category you fall into, you're still going to learn a lot. But really quick, I just want you guys to know that this podcast is available wherever it is that you find quality podcasts, so please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And the website is bedroombeethovens.com. So you can write into the show or buy merch, or see past episodes, or click around and find the social media avenues. But what I really want to plug before we jump into things is the Patreon. It allows me to really feel blessed because listeners join up. $2, that's all it takes. And we have this connection. You know, you show me that you like what I'm doing. It's all love. And in return, I release shows almost a week early. So this very interview, my Patreons, they get it a few days early. So there's value in it for sure. That's patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. It's mostly about support. So I thank you all. Episode 139 with a 13 frontman, Pharaoh March. Yeah, but here we are, you know, 30 years after Who Stole My Last Piece of Chicken. And I always joke with people who have, you know, like if you've never seen a Fast and Furious movie before, I tell them, go watch the first one where they're stealing VHS players on the back of semi trucks, and then watch the last one where they're off on the shores of Cuba, crisscrossing the globe to stop anarchists from unleashing chaos and stop nuclear weapons. Like you go from racing for pink slips to gathering nuclear bomb codes. And I feel like that's the same. If you listen to Who Stole My Last Piece of Chicken, and then you go to Time for an Exorcism, it seems like, you know, that it's that much different from each other.
There's always been that juxtaposition and that dichotomy and that whole scale oxymoron in terms of my beginning, hence organized confusion. Like, even on that album, you got Wind of Us through Last Piece of Chicken, you know, Prisoners of War and Hypnotical Gases. Like post-apocalyptic themes are still on that record. So for, you know, singing is still on that record. Like a gospel record is still on that record. Like the hood is still on that record. So when you know, my manager was saying lately that on the second record, Extinction Agenda, he was like, it is almost a perfect caption if you peel back a few layers of dudes who were literally in the midst of the height of the crack era in New York City and Queens, South Jamaica, Pappy Mason, Fat Cat, Supreme Team, but also nerds in those themes of like comic book fans and navigating through that whole situation. I mean, it's incredible when you think about it, even adapting to the lifestyle. Like, you know, I was talking to OC the other day, not to incriminate anybody in a crew, about how we would roll to shows with like machine guns, Glocks, sawed-offs, like when we would do out of town shows, like how crazy and, you know, ignorant it was for us to be that heavy going into other states, you know, but we did it. And it was a blend of that mentality and a nerd mentality, because me and Prince both went to art school, and we both enjoyed the things that any kid and any teen should enjoy growing up in that environment. But we wanted to illustrate, you know, both sides of it, the imagination to dream and also the reality of what we were, you know, really dealt with in South Jamaica, Queens.
Yeah, definitely. It was a sign of the times. And, you know, Do Me Right was on the podcast, who was also signed to Funkin' Klein's label. And he was telling me a few stories, like on Hollywood Basic Label Trip, you guys experienced an earthquake in Tokyo.
But on that trip, yeah, man, we were like on the fucking 100th floor. And I'm looking out of this giant window because the building is mostly glass and the building's a swing, like some electric boogie type shit. I mean, swaying. And I'm like, am I bugging, or are these buildings like really swaying right now? And somebody was like, yeah, they're built to do this because we're experiencing an earthquake right now. Cats just hit the floor. Like, I was like, all right, I'm getting dizzy right now. And, you know, all the people obviously from Tokyo are like, and we go through this shit all the time. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me right now? It's crazy. Like, I was under a desk. Like, get the fuck out of here. Like, it was crazy.
So you probably have a little PTSD from going to Japan.
Exactly. That was my first experience.
Yeah. Must have been a little bit more relaxing when you shoot the video for Stress, because that's in Lake Tahoe, you know, so that's a little bit more peaceful.
That's my habitat. Like, I love that environment that we were in Lake Tahoe. Is I'm about to buy a pickup truck now. Like, that's my dream environment. Snowmobiles, pickup truck, going to town, the old man who lives in the woods.
Hey, you know what? The older I get, the more appealing that becomes too.
Yeah, exactly.
So you get on the Lowdown Dirty Shame soundtrack. I know there's a lot of R. Kelly DNA on that album, but it's probably the only place where you're going to find Souls of Mischief, UGK, and Eric Sermon on the same record. I think Patrice Rushen actually wrote on the record. Q-Tip was on there, and it did over 500,000 copies. So that must have been like a nice visibility boost for your music. Maybe people that didn't necessarily know who you are back in the 90s, you know, you could just jump on a really popular movie soundtrack and bam, you're a household name.
Think about how amazing those soundtracks were back then. A lot of people's collections were based off, you know, those compilations and those soundtracks, which were really put together pretty well back then. You know, some really crazy popular songs off of those soundtracks.
Yeah, I remember I had the Above the Rim soundtrack, and I still, to this day, haven't seen the movie. So that's how powerful those vehicles were.
There you go. That sums it up. Like, really, that sums it up, because yeah, a lot of that shit, I would just buy the soundtrack and not even see the movie. That is.
Well, I mean, I know I'm kind of harping on the early days, but it's just interesting because, you know, you go by Simply Too Profound and you release Cooling one day. And I fell down this rabbit hole and figured out that the producer at the time was Paul C. And I had no idea that he died at such an early age. He was only 24 years old. And then I fell down an even further rabbit hole. And Questlove is saying that he was the J. Dilla of his day. So did anything by Paul C., either by watching him crate dig or his sampling philosophy or just the way his mind worked, rub off on you in terms of how to produce records?
It was Simply Too Positive. That was the name, which was later called by Russell Simmons the worst name he ever heard in hip hop history. Minding my own, had to call this bitch. I know Michelle on the telephone. Step to the corner with my beeper, beeping bitches, looking, hooking, peeping. Zodiac, begging pants, with some tennis supporters. Went into a telephone booth, I put a quarter in, made the call. She wasn't there. Yeah, man. Paul, you know, like I've said in other interviews, like as soon as you brought him up, I put on a guard and started compartmentalizing not to get emotional. You know, he was super dope. And I say that as an individual, as a person. He was probably the first person I met that cared so much about music in that way. He was a musician, played bass and drums. His record collection was insane. And he just had an affinity and a appreciation for music deeper than anybody I had met at that time. So for so many reasons, it let me know that you could dig further and you could push further as an artist. It was also just great to meet someone who loved it as much as I did or as we did. And so you would collect these kind of people because it's brand new at the time. And you're like, man, anybody who loves this genre as much as I do, I got to befriend this person, you know? And so as much as he cared about the music, he cared about sampling and the way he went about sampling in the truncation, in the steps and all of that. And it's apparent, you know, you can hear it. A lot of people bounced off that tutelage, the way he did things in that time frame.
Prince Poe coincidentally stopped by his house several hours after he passed away, which resulted in him getting interrogated. Because this was like the late 80s, early 90s, and you know, you guys, like you said, you carried around guns or, you know, whatever. Were you supposed to go with him that day? Are there any crazy stories like that?
We used to move independently for Paul. We both were in the beginning stages of producing. You know, I've me and Paul used to go to the movies together independent of Prince Paul. Same thing with Prince. Like, he would just be like, oh, you're not available, or I'll call Prince. Like, I'm a grab both of y'all or just hang out. Like, and it became a thing where it was like, oh, I just picked up some vinyl. I have an idea. Let me see what Paul is doing. I'll swing by if he's not busy. And drop off these records or drop off this idea or talk to him about an idea or start on a song without Pharaoh, you know. So I don't know the intent. Same thing with me. I had called and left messages. Detectives reached out to me because I was on the answering machine. That's how long ago that was. Like, yo, you know, like, and they just, I guess, traced it and was like, yo, why were you calling? And, you know, just had to explain everything. And speaking of PTSD, like, real talk, like, you know, that was my first time dealing with a murder and then having it be someone so instrumental to your career, instrumental to your personal life. You know, Paul was becoming a good friend. You know, it was just, you know, probably should have got therapy for that shit, be quite honest with you, all of us, because we just chalked it up to the hood and you move on. But, you know, when people bring him up in interviews, I feel a way still to this day.
When you're dealing with that and going back to your music
career and you're navigating through Solid Sound Records, Hollywood Basic, Priority, Raucous, I remember obviously the famous verse saying you're a slave to a label, but you own your masters. Signing the Def Jam was the original goal, right? Even back then during that time, Def Jam kind of like, these are just stepping stones to get to Def Jam.
We were the quintessential rookies, quintessential novice artists. You know, we made a demo with our guy in a basement with him scratching records, flashing records and bringing records back and us rhyming the way it was done in the part. And we just took it back to listen to it. I took my tape home to listen to it. And fortunately, when I got home and I listened back to it, I was able to be like, this is the worst shit I've ever heard in my life. Like, you know, and speaking of myself, I was like, you suck. And I look back and I was like, what a blessing to be able to hear that you suck. Because most people can't hear it. I was like, this isn't good. I know we've been practicing, but it's not up to par with what I like. And we worked and we worked and we worked until my DJ and Prince and I was like, this shit is really good. Like, this shit is, I got goosebumps. And I was like, goosebumps don't come, you know, easily. This is just in the basement with turntables. This is not studio recording, nothing. And so that aspect of it, I think, brought us to a level where we weren't just trying to record, where the shit was like, you know, a different level of technique and skill and musicianship that you don't get anymore, because cats don't practice that way. They don't practice with one microphone, three MCs, when a cat on the turntable having to stay on time, else you fuck up the timing. Or if somebody fucks up the timing, you learn how to work around fucked up timing. All those battle scars turn cats or whip cats into shape to become who we were and to record like we did once we got to that level. You know, independently, we started and then we met Paul. Paul seen us, heard us in the studio and realized that we were cut from that cloth, you know, offered to work with us. And then when we were able to work with him, he was the first one again who was like, this is shit. Like, what is this? Like, count your bars. Like, what type of fucking verse is this? Like, what the fuck's going on? Where's the structure? You know, I'm like, huh? You know, at that time we were getting a little reputation, and these were the first times that people were like, you're not as good as you think you are. You know, like, you need to get it together. What's your favorite band? You know, the same tutelage that the master gives to all the students in this game. Oh, I like Public Enemy. And I'm like, go home and listen to those fucking records and listen to the structure. And then come back. You know, some real fucking Mr. Miyagi shit. Because you guys obviously don't know how to make a record to the capabilities of how I want to, you know, see your potential. And so that's who Paul C was. Yeah. The first person to be like, you could do that again. You could write that better. It needs to end better. So after we worked with Paul C on the demo, we're in the car. Like, even back then, I had paused up like Immigrant Song, Led Zeppelin, and was rhyming over that shit in his car. And he was like, yo, this shit's incredible. Like, who would fucking rhyme over Immigrant Song? Talking early 90s, you know, we did the demo with him, and Bobbito got hold of the demo, and that's how our demo got to Def Jams. Bobbito took it to Russell Simmons along with Nas, and Russell was like, these guys are kissing Kuji Rap's ass and this guy's kissing Rakim's ass. I don't want to sign either of these fucking people. He turned them both down.
Oh, wow.
Later, I found out that he softened up to us. We were on a phone call with him. And he was, you know, he's responsible for Organized Confusion, loosely, because he was like, what the fuck kind of name is Simply Too Positive? You know, I was like, STP, you know, STP, that's the... He was like, bullshit, still sucks, change it. And then I was like, all right. We changed the name to Organized Confusion. And eventually he came back with an offer that was lower than what Hollywood Basic had offered. So, you know, like young kids, we decided to go where the money were and where the freedom was, because we had some understanding that if we went to Def Jams, it would be more of a controlled situation over there than the freedom we had with Hollywood Basic.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And once you get some traction on Organized Confusion and you want to get started on your solo journey, and you ask Poe for your blessing to go in the studio and work on some material to get a deal, what if he said, no, let's just do a hiatus and come back as Organized Confusion? If he would have said that, would Eternal Affairs never have been a thing?
Probably would have never been a thing. But he saw that I was exhausted. The scenario is we were coming out of the Equinox record, which we really worked really hard on that record in terms of the production and skits and storyline. Had a falling out with the label, and I was just exhausted. I needed a hiatus. And the obviously, the routine is run back in the studio. You know, that's the hip-hop routine. Can't take too much time off. Run back in the studio and work on record 4. But I was emotionally drained from that work, traveling back and forth to L.A. The last record was on Priority. I was kind of disappointed with that whole effort. And I was like, fuck this shit, man. I am going to go into hibernation and meditation mode and think about the totality of the whole spectrum of what it takes to put together a good record and not just beats and rhymes. And I took a hiatus. In the hiatus, I'm like, what I found out is I have all of this shit internally that I felt would be unfair. You know, originally, it was a lot of personal shit. Like, that around that time, coming off of that situation is more of what, like, PTSD is about, the album PTSD, which I wasn't going through what I'm rapping about on PTSD during the recording of that album. I was probably going through that around the time of stress going into Equinox, which makes all the sense of internal affairs. It wasn't about, you know, some fucking cop or detective story. It was about me just vomiting out all of these emotions.
Next year is the 15th anniversary of Desire. I just wanted to point out that Alchemist beat was done long before it came out. It was done when you were on Ruckus, and you breathed new life into that. And mm-hmm. Alchemist called you the greatest of all time after that. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I think, being a big sports fan, it's important. Context is important. And as you get older, obviously, you gain more wisdom and insight into lineage and years and era and context. And around that time, you know, it's important to put things into context. Like I heard Yasin say recently, those moments in New York City itself was shaping us as who we were then and who we would become. It's not the same anymore. It's impossible to go back into those moments. So in that time frame, if you think about it, for Alchemist to say that about me says a lot. It's similar to the NBA when the rules were different. You know, if you were in an MVP talk back then, you know, it just was different. Your game was different. Not saying better, but just different. And if you watched the way Jordan was played and the way that he was defensed, you know, you have some context into to why people revere him the way that they do. If you didn't see that, then you don't have any context. So when you tell me that he says that, it blows me away. There's a lot going on at the time. MCs were striving for different things at the time, different love from the audience at the time. Politically, socially, and business-wise, the music industry was just in a completely different place. Monetarily, the economy was different in America at the time. So all of these things were shaping our approach.
So in present time, if we're dealing with the whole world, you had an internal struggle looking inward. What have you been dealing with the last year that's maybe different than back in 06 or 07?
I'm not going to lie. As a dreamer and a sci-fi kid, nerd kid, looking at Star Trek and all the rest of that shit, I didn't think this is where we would be in 2021, politically and socially. Obviously, there's differences going on, but there was, outside of the whole racist shit, which was obviously brought to the light on the Stress album and apparent in my life as a Black man, I thought that we would evolve, not those people, if you're racist, you're racist, whatever, but evolve consciously and the interconnectedness of us all globally and find a greater camaraderie. I thought the camaraderie amongst us as humans would grow and strengthen as we would be able to see that we're just borrowing this time anyway. What sense does it make to be selfish in so many different ways? And this was like the thoughts that I had as a kid. So in the division that we have right now, it's very disheartening. Not even just as a Black man, but it's just disheartening as a fucking human. I'm like, this is fucking repulsive. They got us. Because if you could have division amongst the people who would normally be divided for things that can be remedied, not easily remedied, but remedied, then the trajectory is off. Because it's only natural that things evolve. And in that sense, it's shaping how I think about and how I create. You either create through it, create about it, or you're not even noticing what's going on. And then that type of art even feeds the people who are unaware of where we're at. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it seems like your perspective on the world kind of reflects on who you are as an artist and how you kind of perform creatively.
Exactly. I want to, if you get it, if I feel you get me vibrationally, and then I'm going to do this shit for you and try to bring some joy to your consumption of art in that sense.
I mean, because going with that, and you know, I might be off base with this, but I feel like, you know, Simon Says is a very hard song for you to enjoy, because I don't know if Brian and Jarrett Meyer, maybe you've entrusted a process to them. You entrusted a sample to get some kind of clearance, and it might have been a mistake due to you being so young. And by trusting them with the process, it kind of soured maybe you sampling or enjoying the music for X amount of time, because this lawsuit for $12,000 blew up to $500,000. And maybe in hindsight, Rocka should have paid that and avoided the spider web of headaches that ensued. And maybe
absolutely 100% the business of this was totally fucked up and terrible. At the same time, the evolving of it is divine, and also I am where I'm supposed to be in this moment, in this interview, exactly where I'm supposed to be. Why do I say that? I absolutely love that song, and I absolutely perform that song in a stadium with the love and fervor and joy that I always did for a stadium or for a fucking bar of 8 drunk people. I love the record. I understand what the record has done for me. I understand what the record could have been. But I also understand in my twisted X-Men fucking brain that alternate reality would have been, this sample is cleared, you're a multimillionaire. I don't know if it would have been the right thing for me to do to buy a Ferrari in New York City in that time, but I definitely would have. And we don't know what would have happened. I don't know what would have happened. And so you can't look back that way. I mean, in the moment, I'm like, you stupid motherfuckers. But as the wise old man, I'm not there with it. I haven't been there with it in quite some time, because I know that I am where I am exactly supposed to be. I mean that literally. I mean that, of course, I could run a scenario where I'm already in the woods. My house is 5 miles off the main road. It's made of red oak and glass. And there's a secret escape way back to the back roads through the basement in case of a zombie apocalypse. And it's my dream home. That could be the scenario. And the scenario could also be, remember Pharoah Monch, he drove his Ferrari off the 59th Street Bridge into the fucking river.
Oh yeah, you remember Pharoah Monch? He got in the studio with Jimmy Page and Puff Daddy, and and made a song for the Godzilla soundtrack that didn't age very well.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not alone, because Toho, they sued Rugrats, the cartoon Rugrats, which contributed to them going off the air. They're very notorious for doing that. And I prefer, like, you know, like who was it, Ronnie Size did an amazing remix of Simon Says. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of him. It's heralded a classic, and sure, I mean, the Puff Daddy song could, I mean, they probably poured millions and millions and millions into that. And samples are a bitch. They're a bitch. And did you know that Every Breath You Take, the song that he did for Biggie with the police sample, he pays Sting $2,000 a day for that sample because he didn't ask him for it. And they settled it after he took it without asking. So because Biggie died, Sting literally never has to work a day in his life ever if he chose. And I read stuff like that. And it's such a fickle business and crazy how things work out. So I'm glad you have that perspective. Like, your life is the way it's supposed to be. Everything kind of panned out the way it's supposed to be, and it seems like you're the happiest that you've ever been. Like, you landed a late night show 30 years after Organized Noise started. You know, you're telling me no Letterman visits, no Leno, no Kimmel, no SNLs, but it's finally happening with this new group. It's awesome.
It's amazing. And I am, you know, people who know me, they know, basically, I mean, these are friends from Hall C. You know, I was talking to my best friend who came to the show we had in Brooklyn, and he said he was in tears because he knows how long I've been talking about a project like this. He's seen the different incarnations of this project, me being like, yo, I'm a rap over immigrant song, to nah, you know, anybody can rap over immigrant song. I need to find cats who are nice enough to fucking make immigrant song. You know, my manager being like, you know, I know you've been talking about this shit for 10 years, but it's not real unless it's real. And as a fan of both genres, he was like, I'm not going to take you seriously, you know, about what I hear coming out of your mouth versus what I'm seeing. And was super instrumental in me being like, yeah, I agree with you. As a you know, fan of both genres, I don't want to bastardize either genre. And in the past, when people have done these mashups, I haven't liked the MCs or the rhymes or the bars or the songs. Or I like the MCs and I didn't like the production, or I like the MCs and it didn't quite, you know, I'm like, it's not funky enough. It's not black enough. It's not rock enough. It's not soulful enough. It's not dark enough. You know, it would always be a version of it that would fail somewhere with me and on the chart in terms of checking the boxes for me. And so, you know, people who know me know that I spent a lot of time in being like, I want the rhymes to be a certain way. I want it to still feel like hip hop, but I want it to be so rock that hip hop dudes are like, what the fuck is he doing? You know, and that's a hard balance to get. I want it to be so dark that people are like, what the fuck is this photo stuff?
Eureka, Franklin, D. Roosevelt, Franklin, Collins, Ferguson, Rick James, Brown, Ferguson, son, come on, son, 13, I'm on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Jackson's in action, my eyes are stained glass, look through, see the labor pains, when my brain goes into contractions, crack pipes, Wesley Snipes, all over the city like stop signs, fall back, pull out the
X. At the end of the day, you know you're selling something, but then you're still trying to please the hardest critic since day one, which is myself. And like an amazing comedy sketch, to go back to the beginning, I was like, you suck and you need to work at your bars. And you know, I was a fucking beatbox. And luckily I was able to be like, you could be nasty at this shit, but this ain't it. And I'm that critic. I'm working at pleasing me. Not to say that what pleases me pleases everyone, but to just check the boxes on, these drums are too loud. Like, nobody in rock music fucking makes their kicks and snares like a Tribe record, because it's not fucking Tribe records. It's a rock record. Let's do this. Let's pull back. Let's blend these in. Oh, you know what though? Let's make this record knock like a White Stripes record, because Jack White is perennial fucking insane with his drums, and let's go for that shit. Like, and that's what we did. So everybody who knows me know that how pleased that I am with the project.
And yet Post Malone, who wasn't even alive when you started doing music, has an Ozzy Osbourne feature on his last album. Obviously you're deserving of it. What is it? Is it popularity, label, politics, legal tape that prevents Ozzy from appearing on a track like 666?
We were more interested in getting the fucking music cleared than we were with getting Ozzy on the record. Like, Ozzy on that record is a stunt, but that's not what my, you know, the song has no fucking chorus. So obviously I'm like, I'm a rhyme for a year on this record, you know, like it's bar heavy. So it wasn't structured that way. But I mean, that would be a dream come true. Planting Ozzy, like if I got Plant on a song, I would just quit. I wouldn't even do any more music. I might not be able to afford my house in the woods, but I would get a gang of Feral March fans and they would help me build that fucking house in the woods. And that's where I would stay. And people would be like, yo, after the Plant record came out, he just was a recluse and fucking moved to the woods by the lake.
a little Osborne, a little Plant, even some Eugene McDaniels in there. Just throw it all in.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man.
I do want to give you the floor for anything that I did not cover with the new project, but I know that there's graphic novels. You have a music video out that's all animated that is just beautiful.
Kill, Kill, Kill. Yeah, it's an animated video illustrated by this guy out of the UK named See Through. I wrote it. I sent them the script. I saw some work he did online. He loved the script. We worked on the ending of the story together, the twist. And so far, we've won Venice Short Animated Film Award. We've won 2 film awards, and we just got nominated for Cannes Animated Short. Nobody knows that yet, but we got nominated. We didn't win, but we're in the running for Cannes. That shit's crazy. Like, it's just unbelievable.
Man, you from art school to Cannes. Talk about a journey.
Oh my God, man, it's amazing. And these are the little things that are my go-to when I'm not having the best of days. I've trained myself to be grateful and humble and thankful.
I'm very self-aware of who you are. Anyone in my position should be honored because of what you've done for hip hop art and music. I think it's just tremendous. And I'm glad we could link up, man. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you, man. Thank you.